This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. It's great to have you listening today. This week, Lake Effect producer Stephanie Lecce is exploring issues surrounding death and dying in the 21st century. Indeed, the questions surrounding end-of-life care today are much different from the way they were in the past. Technology is allowing us to live longer with more disease and to sustain life even when we are no longer able to communicate our wishes. As we heard yesterday, that can put a lot of stress on caregivers making proxy decisions. But how did we get here? And what do we have to consider when we try to lay out our wishes ahead of time? Dr. Arthur Dursey is the director of the Center for Bioethics and Medical Humanities at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He tells Stephanie Lecce why the dying process is so much more complicated today.
We didn't have this problem 60 years ago because we didn't have the technology to do the amazing things that we're able to do today. We didn't have ventilators. We didn't have feeding tubes. We didn't have dialysis. We didn't have the ability to transfuse blood in the way that we do now. We didn't have the antibiotics we have. We didn't have transplantation. So all of these things are fairly recent developments. And at the same time, you know, back in the day when people died, there wasn't a lot that could be done. Now there's all these things that can be done. And the real challenge for us is differentiating prolonging dying from actually extending life. And I think that's the real challenge for us. And the fact that for many people at the end of life, there will be a significant period of time where they will be unable to speak, unable to say what they would want. And when you do surveys looking at what people want at the end of life, in general, they don't want expensive technology in the hospital. They don't want to be supported by machines. So these surveys show that. And yet at the same time, many people do not say that, do not make their loved ones aware of it, do not fill out the advanced care planning documents, the advanced directives, including the power of attorney for healthcare and the living will, that would allow people to send that message to family members and to be able to honor their wishes in that way.
Well, how did the ethics of end-of-life care and the legalities of end-of-life care develop? How did we get to where we are today in terms of what we have a right to do, what we legally can do, and what we can't?
Well, the story is actually a very compelling one because up until the 1950s, we really couldn't do a whole lot. So there wasn't really a legal issue or much of an ethical issue. Generally, doctors erred on the side of treatments, and often their treatments, you know, might not work or wouldn't work at all. So with the development of the ventilator and with the development of defibrillation, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, those two things gave us a new ability to keep patients alive for long periods of time, often without the ability to speak, often unconscious, often in states that are now known as persistent vegetative states. And in fact, this was such a conundrum that a group of Catholic anesthesiologists asked Pope Pius XII back in the 1950s, what should we do if we stop this treatment? You know, we may be killing the patient, or at least that's our understanding. And the Pope's statement at that time was that there may be things that are extraordinary, that are things that are beyond what ought to be done. And for extraordinary treatments, they can be discontinued. And there was some direction about that. On the legal side in the United States, we also tended to think once you start treating a patient, you have the legal obligation to continue. Stopping that treatment of the patient would result in the patient's death, and that would be at the least negligence and at the worst homicide. And we really grappled with that because we found more and more things that we could do. In fact, in 1976 in the Karen Ann Quinlan case, the New Jersey Supreme Court looked for the first time at the issue of whether or not a ventilator once begun could be stopped. As far as the law went, it appeared as if that was a direct homicide. The New Jersey Supreme Court made the differentiation, which many courts have done since, and the U.S. Supreme Court has done as well, differentiated the withdrawal of life-sustaining medical treatment, the things that kept the person alive, from the intent to cause death. And when people were dependent upon technology and the technology was withdrawn, their death was the result of their withdrawal of this dependent technology, not of the doctor's intent or anyone else's to cause the patient's death. And the reason the Karen Ann Quinlan case was so important is she couldn't tell us what she wanted, even though some of the things she wanted was inferred from her statements and from her religious tradition. But that case began a series of cases over about 14 years before the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in on the issue. The U.S. Supreme Court in 1990 in the Nancy Beth Cruzan case declared that a feeding tube medically delivered, you know, it is put in by a physician and it's a medical procedure, and that's something that can be withdrawn. In this case, Missouri could also ask for clear and convincing evidence. Missouri, the show me state, wanted to know that she really, really didn't want a feeding tube. But people do have this right to be free of life-sustaining medical treatment in the form of ventilators and fluid nutrition, other medical technologies that prolong life. So the principles that withdrawal and withholding of medical treatment is not homicide or suicide was established, as was the fact that patients have the right to be free of unwanted technologies. They can't be forced. And so there was a major change, a sea change, in which a new orientation came to be. And now it's part of just the social understanding. There was one other major change as well, and that was the U.S. Supreme Court was asked after a number of federal cases and state cases tried to litigate whether or not patients could ask for assistance in suicide by a physician, medical assistance. And they were asked, do people have the right to die? The U.S. Supreme Court unanimously, I should say, said no, they don't have the right to ask to die.
So at the end of the day, what do all of these developments mean for your average person who probably is healthy right now, sitting listening to us on the radio right now? What do we take from this broader conversation, the legal implications, the bioethical developments, in terms of how we decide what steps to take to ensure that we die well?
One, you have to realize that it is very likely that you will not be able at the end of life at some point to be able to express your wishes. And it's really, really, really important to be able to do that ahead of time through two means. One is through the use of one of the advance directives, one known as a power of attorney for healthcare, which is a document that says to your doctor, here is the person that will speak for me, and they will reflect my wishes and values, and you can, with them, work out, you know, what should happen. And in that document, your wishes and values should also be spelled out. Another document is a living will, which is more of a direct message to your doctor saying, dear doctor, this is my wish. If I'm in a terminal condition and I can't speak, here's what I would like done under the circumstances. Some people choose that as a way to be able to get that information across. At the very least, besides filling out these, you should also have that conversation with your doctor. And I'm sorry if your doctor hasn't had it with you already, because your primary care doctor is the person who should know that and will document it in the medical chart and encourage you, if you haven't filled out an advance directive, to do so. And then perhaps a more difficult conversation is to let your family members know. And that's really important, because for many family members, this has not been discussed. For many family members, they have a vague notion of what someone would want under the circumstances. And we have seen this many, many times when individuals have not stated what they wish. Family members who feel awful about the situation say, I don't know, why don't we continue to do things? Because I just don't want to say stop. And you shouldn't, as an individual, put that burden on your family members to essentially have to make decisions. They will make decisions with the doctors, but it is so much easier if you've stated what you want. And amazingly, in the studies about the people who look at physician-assisted suicides in the states in which it's allowed, it's not pain, it's not finances that really drive their decision-making. It's their inability to, you know, their self-control, and then also the burden they feel to other people. And that burden is a very real one. And one of the legacies I think that many people don't want to leave is being that burden. We've heard it from people saying that, and giving the family permission, in essence, to follow your wishes and to do what you think ought to be done in the situation is an important message to convey and will relieve a burden from them of even having to decide.
How can you possibly anticipate all the different kinds of technologies that might come into play with your treatment? I mean, what should we be thinking about with each one of these options in terms of, do I want this? Do I not want this?
Stephanie, that's a great question. The reason it's a great question is because the main purpose of an advance directive is to give directions to your physician and family members or the agent who's going to be your power of attorney for healthcare about your values, because the technology will change. So saying, oh, I want to be resuscitated if there's a code, or I don't want to be resuscitated, that may change depending upon your health, depending upon whether or not it's going to work. So the medical technologies will change. Now, there are some that the Wisconsin legislature have mandated. So you must choose whether or not your agent will be allowed to stop artificial nutrition and hydration. But for the most part, I don't think it's important to put the technologies in there. I think it's more important to put your values, what you find important. And in advanced care planning documents, there's always a section to say, you know, I value an interactive life more than a long life. I value this more than that. And those values are the things that are central and key to the decision making. I think some people do want to be very specific. And certainly if you say, I would never want to be on a ventilator, you might write that. But the problem is if you have an allergic reaction that we can easily treat with a ventilator for a short period of time, that might be a totally appropriate thing. But if you're going to be on a ventilator as you're dying from cancer, you may say, oh, I that's not what I would want. And so I think translating your values in light of the medical situation is your doctor's responsibility, and your doctor should be informing your healthcare agent or your family about what interpreting your wishes, what they think is most appropriate in that state. So I think the main thing is just get an advance directive filled out, have an agent selected, tell them something about your values, but write down those values in that document. There's free documents available from the Wisconsin Department of Health that you can get a hold of. They are legally valid in Wisconsin. And the majority of people don't fill them out, although patients who are facing end of life, more and more of them do. And some studies, encouraging studies actually, show that now the majority of people who are facing end of life are now beginning to fill them out. So people walking around the street, not as many, but people who realize there's a medical problem, now they are filling them out. And the second really exciting part of this is that studies are showing that if you indicate what you want, it's highly likely that your doctor and your family will follow your wishes. Back in the day, the rap on advance directives was, well, first of all, they don't do much, and secondly, you know, doctors ignore them. That may have been true then, not true now. That was then, this is now, and now they actually do something, and doctors and families adhere to them.
Well, Dr. Art Dersey, thank you so much for coming in.
Stephanie, thank you very much.
Dr. Art Dersey is the director of the Center for Bioethics and Medical Humanities at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce as part of our series on death and dying. We'll hear more from him later in the series, which continues tomorrow, and there's more at wuwm.com/legeffect. We'll take a break now and then explore how the Civil War influenced our understanding of the concept of freedom. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.